This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 5th of October, 1956. The title of this lecture is Portions of You. This lecture is 61 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
I want to talk to you now about you. Because there's a lot of you that you think is you that isn't you. That's the other fellow. In order to get a very clear understanding of this, and in order to show you what I mean when I say we're very close to being there in that search, you should know that man has considered himself a whole when he is a composite. And unless he knows he is a composite, then he will never understand the other fellow. He himself experiences certain actions and reactions which he cannot thoroughly explain. This worries him. So he knows the other fellow doesn't know what he's doing either. So one of the first things that he does is compare himself to the other fellow. That's a mistake. Because the other fellow is doing the same thing. The other fellow is a bundle of worry about you 90% of the time. Now let's look at that. What part of you wants to know about the other fellow? Let's be very precise here. What part of your specific beingness desires to know what the other fellow is doing? Well, it happens to be you, a thetan. Now, thetan is a mathematical term. It isn't a religious term. The reason it's used at all is because there is no adequate term. We've had to invent a new term. Well, why have we had to? Very simple. Spirit does not convey much meaning. A spirit is, that's what it is. And a demon is something that you would object to being called. I don't think you'd like to go around being referred to as a demon, yet this is a common term. A demon actually is a thetan plus some sort of bric-a-brac. We're not quite sure what that's all about, but the bric-a-brac itself is the demon, not the being. Now, we take this beingness called a thetan, and we discover that it is the prime impulse of this universe. That's an interesting thing to be able to put your finger on. Say, this is the prime impulse of this universe. Now, what do you know about that? And its definition is axiom one. And its composites and behaviors are axioms 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And to say its highest purpose is axiom 10. Solved. And that's for sure. That's been in our hands here for a long time. Every once in a while, we take a look back at axioms 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and we say, hey, what do you know? They're correct. I found out they were right myself just a few months ago. Now, we have then exact descriptive axioms which represent this thing called a thetan. And a thetan most closely relates to these other items, spirit, soul, demon, so on. It's a close relationship, but it isn't exactly it. Because a spirit, according to Christian terminology, would be a thetan with a mission. See, so that's something additive right there. That's a thetan with a mission. He is somebody who doesn't want to go to hell and is trying to go to heaven and trying to get somebody to give him a straight road map. Now, that according to that. Now, I'm not being facetious. This is, let's be factual for a change, huh? And a demon is somebody that's lost the way entirely and couldn't find hell and came back. And he's mad about it. Well, if that's the case, what is a soul? Well, boy, you got me. I wouldn't even vaguely know what a soul was, because they keep talking about your soul, and people keep saying my soul. Well, we have a joke in Scientology that all of you know very much. We talk about the person who says he is over there. Now, the fellow who says I am over there is doing something quite remarkable. He's standing where he is and pointing to a spot where he's not and saying he's in the spot where he's not. See, that's quite tricky. A being, of course, is himself, and he is where he is, and that's where he is. He's not someplace else. So we talk about this thing of, I'm over there, and every now and then we exteriorize somebody, say, somebody be 3 feet back of your head, or we use something like this, and the fellow says, well, I'm back there now. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. No, he's not. No, he's not. He maybe put a viewpoint back there. He did something, so he didn't go back there. That's certain. All right, then when they start talking about my soul, it's one of these statements of, I'm over there, don't you see? Now, one of the funnier gags that occurred in one of the early ACCs was an auditor was criticizing another auditor's session, and he said, if I did that badly, I'd just turn in my thetan. And that's gorgeous, but this is the same category of thing as my soul. See, you have to take care of your soul. Now, how do you do that? See? It's factual, say you have to be careful where you're going and what you're doing. You might say that, and that's factual. But to say you have to take care of your something becomes quite non-factual, because there isn't anything there comparable to a thetan to take care of, unless, of course, a fellow was a schiz. And he might be quite double-natured or something, but again, he would not be himself. So let's look this over then in its fairest categories, and let's see quite easily that an individual is himself and is a thetan. And a thetan is a specific thing. It is a life giving unit. That's what it is. It is not a living unit. It couldn't do anything else. Now you say, what is it possible for a thetan to do? It is possible for a thetan to give life. You say, what is a thetan? A thetan is a life-giving unit. Yeah, but what about a thetan living? Well, I don't know. What about bricks being made out of brick? Well, that's not a very profound statement. All bricks are made out of brick, you say. When better bricks are made, they will be made out of brick. But it's the same thing as saying a thetan is living. He himself actually is not life. He gives life, don't you see? Because the first thing that we think of in terms of life is a life form. And if we have a life form, then it is something to which life has been given. Well, how about the thing that gave life? That must be alive too. Well, that's sort of naturally. All bricks are made out of brick. But a thetan isn't making himself alive. This is quite unique. He is not making himself alive. He is alive. In other words, we have recovered here prime impulse, prime motivator. We have discovered not the prime thought, something much better than that, the thinker of the prime thought with regard to life. And that is this thing called a thetan. Now, he has no mass. Until he thinks one up, he has no meaning. He actually doesn't even have mobility unless he postulates it. Well, this is a very curious thing. He makes the space in which he moves. And he can't move until he's made some space, and he says then, I am moving in the space, but this is very silly, because he made the space in which he's moving, so how could he be moving in that space? He couldn't be, don't you see? He must be moving the space around him. He's saying, I am here, and I am moving. Something like sticking your head at the back of a box, and you say, now I'm going to move forward to the front of the box, and you move the box backward. And of course, you're now in the front of the box. That's all set. Now you say, well, I've moved the length of this box. That's what a thetan does. He does this very well. Now, he does many things. It's very interesting. You want to know how many things he does? Well, just look around you, and you will see walls, and you will see carpets, and you will see living bodies, and you will see lights, and you will see some flags, and these are just a few of the things he does. He makes these things. He uses these things. He moves them around. And he gives life to them or not, as the case may be. Now that wall is alive to the extent that it is perceptible. Why is it perceptible? Because it was said that it was there and it could be perceived. And then we had a lot of agreement on this subject, and boy, we got a solid wall. Now somebody in the field of religions can come along and say, there's no mass of any kind anywhere. It's all an illusion. Nah. What an invalidation of somebody's postulates. That's not true. The postulate is true, because we agreed it was true. We agreed there were walls there, and then somebody comes along and says, there are no walls anyplace. Boy, did he just take a lot of mass away from you. So, the physical universe is true, and space is true, and all these things are true, because we agree they're true. That's all there is to that. Simple. All right. Then this unit is capable of giving life. It is alive. It can't help itself. It can say, I am now dead or unconscious, and even stick with the postulate for a while. But not very successfully. The one thing a thetan can't do is unlive. He is. He is alive. He does not have mass. He is not energy. He is a true static. Now, the physicist's definition of a static becomes incomprehensible to the physicist once you explain it to him. It's a very funny experience, by the way, and I'm sure Scientologists have discombobulated a lot of physicists. They've done terrible things to physicists. Physicists come along and, you know, he knows all about science. He starts, by the way, with a rather amusing assumption that energy is conserved. It cannot be destroyed. It cannot be created. It is. Then somebody, by remedy of havingness, by mock-ups, shoving him into his body, runs his poundage up, or runs it down. How did he do that? Well, conservation of energy, of course, has even been exposed today as a fraud in nuclear physics. And it no longer exists as a stable datum of physics, which puts all physics more or less in chaos. That's what it ought to be. So this engineer comes along and the Scientologist tells him, now, life is a static. Life is a static. That's what life is. And this engineer says, well, something in an equilibrium of forces, eh? No, it's a static. Well, that's easy. He says, now look at this ashtray sitting on the table here. That is a static too. And the physicist becomes discombobulated when you point something out to him that has never occurred to him before, that this favorite item of his, a static, is actually en route at 1,000 miles an hour just to follow the revolutions of Earth. So his static is so unstatic that it is already traveling 1,000 miles an hour in one direction, and there are 7 other directions due to the incidence of the movement of the solar system and this galaxy. That's a lot of directions for this static to be moving in. So he pointed to the ashtray and he said, that's in an equilibrium of forces. The Scientologist says, oh, no, it isn't. Proves it to him. The physicist goes, quiver, confused. If at that moment you said you were a dog or something of the sort, he'd probably bark. Because you've put him into an overtly put him into confusion. A static is something which is not, you don't have to define it as something in an equilibrium of forces. You can just say it isn't moving. And that's a static. And that's what a thetan is. It just isn't. But he can say he can move, and he can say that he can see in various parts of space, so that you can say to a thetan, be 3 feet back of your head. And he starts seeing 3 feet back of his head and not seeing in his head. It's as simple as that. And then he tells you that I moved 3 feet back of my head. Well, that's just the apparency of the situation. He didn't do that at all. He appeared someplace else. And that is the way he did it. It's a nice trick. You don't even need mirrors. Now, he'd play the Dickens. He'd just play the Dickens, having his body sit in the chair, and then his body be 3 feet back without moving in the intervening space. He couldn't take his body and move it 3 feet backwards without crossing the 3 feet of space, could he? But that's because it's a body. That's because it's a mass. And that's because it obeys the laws of motion, space, and mass. It is that thing which it is, just as a thetan is what it is. That's very simple. So it comes down to this final analysis. We say a thetan is a spirit, doesn't have mass, doesn't have location, really, unless it postulates its location. Then what does it do? Well, it creates masses, it creates spaces, it does all these things, and then we have a universe. Well, if that is the case, then aren't we all the same static? Well, I don't know, I haven't run into you lately. Have you run into me? Which, by the way, just settles that right on down to the ground. I mean, it's the simplest proof. It is so simple, it is very foolish. How many angels can occupy the head of one pin? Ta, who cares? Must be a silly sort of an angel to be dancing around on a pin when there's so many when there's so many perfectly good ballrooms. Now, here then is what the thetan is capable of doing. He's capable of giving life. Look that up. He's capable of giving life. That is what he's capable of doing. Now, he's capable also of withdrawing life. If he can give it, he can take it away, and that's certain. It's a funny thing, but some good driver who's a fairly high-toned fellow gets in a car, the car purrs on down the road, just smooth, everything. He gets out of the car and goes into a house, and his friend comes out, who's a real low-toned dog, and sits under the wheel of the car, and the motor won't start, and it won't purr down the road, and it won't stop when he turns off the ignition key. All sorts of interesting things occur, which we, of course, immediately forget about and blind ourselves to, because we say, well, it should be that a car is simply a car. Well, a car isn't simply a car. In a more temperamental vehicle, a motorcycle, with which I have some small acquaintance, this is much more manifest. Much more manifest. Motorcycles just won't start for some people, that's all. A pretty good motorcycle. He can pump himself enough so that if it were running on a spring motor, it would run for miles. And the thing still is not running as a vehicle. Well, then, if we have this difficulty, we can always say, well, it's the ignition, something like that. But that doesn't get explained on motorcycles. Even motorcycle mechanics, who are the least observing people on Earth, they can see a flat tire and pass it right by. They can see a cracked cylinder head and put it right back into the motor. I mean, no observation character here at all. We'll always say to you, oh, didn't you know that motorcycles behave different for different riders? They know that well. And one shop, by the way, had one rider that motorcycles behaved very, very well for, and he always tested the machines. Of course, they always ran for him, and so we returned to the customers fixed. It takes an extraordinary amount of endowment of life of a motorcycle to keep it running for everybody. Now, that is the contest of a manufacturer. That's his contest, is to keep it running from everybody. He's got to put enough livingness, holding togetherness, and functionalness into the motorcycle, crunch, you know, in order to keep it running for just anybody. And then that's considered a very good machine. And then you change the manager of the factory or something of the sort, and his machines don't run for everybody anymore. And the motorcycle riders don't buy them anymore. It's quite remarkable. Yet really nothing happened. Don't you see this? Not actually. Nothing occurred in the construction of the motorcycle. It just suddenly wouldn't run anymore. Now, we don't have to use these examples at all. Let's use another machine, a body. Much more interesting machine, much more complicated. Because it's under one rider, usually. And this chap has his own peculiarities, and there are very, very few set down principles on how to run a body. In fact, I've never read a textbook. One of these fine days, I've been threatening, I'm going to write one. How to run a body. How to shift vertebrae. How to chew food. How to blow the nose properly. You know, just all these little tiny things, and just write an operating manual of how you do these things now. Because in essence, the body is a machine. It is a nice machine. It's a biological machine. It is put together. We're not sure that it's put together out of cells, but it is hung together. Some of them are just hung together, too. And we can see in this type of machinery, this biological machinery of one kind or another, we can see the effects of two things at work. One, the maker of the machine, that is, its biological track line. We can see the influence there, and we can see the influence of the current proprietor and operator. These two influences are at once apparent, and then there's a third one that comes in, is the effect of the environment upon the machine distinct from the use of the operator of the machine. So we have the way the machine was built, the environment's effect on the machine, and the person who is operating the machine. We have these three factors present, and we get the condition of the machine. Now, we can see that somebody in a cold country is apt to do interesting things with a body. We can even understand Russian humor. The Russian lives in a terribly cold climate. It's very cold. I have seen something of this climate, and it's quite fantastic. I mean, a fellow who doesn't look straight at it and inspect it and walk around in it for a while just wouldn't believe it. You know, your ears are in the condition where you are being very careful not to touch them too suddenly because they'd fly off, you know. And all kinds of interesting things. He's engaged all the time in trying to hold in all possible body heat and drink all kinds of vodka in order to generate more body heat to hold in. He's having a bad time trying to balance these factors involved with his body. Well, if we look over the Russian climate, we can then understand the effect of the environment upon the Russian body. And we can see that Russian bodies would be this way and that way and would modify this way and that way to address the environment. Now we can look at Russian lineage, and we can see and predict the manufacture of new Russian bodies. What is the genetic line of these bodies? Tartars, Mongols, Caucasians, whatever. This is Swedish, whatever they laughingly call a Russian body. I don't know of any such thing called a Russian body, by the way. Its genetic line involves, oh, I don't know, 50,000 races? Something goofy like that. I mean, it's astronomic. People get into the steppes and freeze to death, and new people have to come in all the time. And you get this mixed up. And you never saw quite so many languages as are spoken in Russia. Somebody says factuously, I'm going to learn Russian. I just actually have to put a beam on my tongue at that moment. say, which Russian, you know? Official Russian, or school Russian, or stage Russian? That would be the least of it. Are you going to learn Georgian? On and on and on, all these languages. Well, this tells you that there'd be a variability in this body because of the manufacturing plate on it. Right? And then there would be the body operator. How he thinks or is taught that he should handle or run a body. And all these factors would go together. Somebody, looking at it carelessly, would say, well, the behaviorist, he says the environment modifies. He would only see the environment modifying the body, and he would try to understand everything the body was doing and everything wrong with it by looking over its environment, don't you see? He'd say cold weather and this and that and so on. And this, therefore, is the cause of Russian behavior. Now, somebody else would come along and say, a geneticist, you know, and he'd say, well, look at all these races and the tangle of these races. You can see these influences. That explains Russian behavior. Nobody so far has looked at the operator. That seems to be very funny. You see a railroad locomotive going down the track, exceeding the railroad speed limit, going around the curve at 15 miles an hour too fast, you would not say it was the railroad locomotive. And you would not say it was the curve. You would certainly say it was the engineer. And unless somebody starts looking at the engineer, now and then he'll have an awful time trying to understand behavior or genetic lines or anything else. Because the engineer is by far the most important of these factors. And the engineer, the driver, the operator of a body is a Thetan. That's all. And he operates that body to the degree that he can, to the degree that he respects it, to the degree that he thinks of other people's influences upon it, you see? But all of these things are going through the mind of the operator of that body. Now, what's his mind? Well, that's a collection of experiences he's kept in mental image pictures, which he shuffles like decks of cards when he hasn't got anything else to do. That's his mind. Now, he takes advice from this because it knows by experience. But in the final analysis, the only reason it is alive to give him any advice is because he makes it alive. Now let's look at another factor. How well is the body? Although the environment and incidents and accidents and the genetic line can all modify this factor, these modifications are minor compared to this one. How alive can he make a body? How alive can the operator engineer make? Now, the Thetan is an item that gives life. That is what it does. It gives life or it withholds life. And if it says the body is bad and the environment is bad and the genetic line is bad, it withholds life and we have a thick, sick, stupid body. And if he says, well, the body's all right and I can overcome the environment and the other fellow isn't so bad, then we have a body that is alive. What is the difference between life and death? The difference is an operator. We are never discussing the life or death of a spirit, never discussing the life or death of a Thetan. We're discussing the life or death of the items in which he is in connection. Is he still using them? Which depends on answering this question, are they still usable? And is there any purpose remaining for their use? And if we answer those questions, then we have the answer to whether or not he's dead or whether or not he's alive. You could actually see somebody pine away and perish just because he doesn't have any reason to go on using the body. You know, the body was doing fine and then all of a sudden this and that and the other thing happened. The game all got messed up and ruined and became too complicated and upset. And the fellow knew that the other fellow was very bad anyhow and he couldn't handle him and he couldn't handle anything. So he says, I don't know, let's fold up. And we see this fellow go downhill and get upset and go through various vicissitudes. And that's his existence, getting bad. He's going to pieces, we say. Why don't we be factual about the other fellow? We would say he is granting less life to the body. Not less life than he should. That's a critical statement. He says no more and no less than just simply granting less life. It's just as silly as that. I mean, as simple as this. He could grant less and less life until he granted no life and you'd have a stiff. You see, with the ease with which this would take place? Now, question comes up, how live could you make this wall? Well, the first place, not supposed to be alive. Supposed to stand there and keep people from walking through it. That's all it's supposed to do. You're not supposed to look through it and so forth. But in the process of eating your breakfast, you imbibe pieces of walls. And then you incorporate them into the body, and now you say they're a live body, and you move it around, and that proves it's alive, and there you are. See how simple this is? So you really are, on a lot of vias, making the wall alive, or pieces of stuff that look like pieces of wall. But that wall is there. Now that wall can come to pieces. You can batter it down. It can become dust. It can get so that it doesn't stop anybody anymore. And we'd say then the wall has no further purpose. Well, a Thetan who wanted a wall there, now seeing it battered down, is liable to have it hauled away because he doesn't want a wall there anymore. In other words, what's the purpose for the mass in the space? Well, this to a large degree determines on whether or not a Thetan wants to make it alive or not. Do you see how simple and elementary that is? Well, how about the other fellow? If you're not willing that his body should be alive, then you're not willing for him to make the body alive. In the absence of life, there's no communication. If you think he ought to be dead, he shouldn't be permitted to go on living, you have denied your environment one body, or have made in your environment a body which is not able. In fact, it's a funny, very funny thing here. If you want enemies, you've got to be willing to grant them life. In other words, gee, a fella has to be good-hearted to have enemies. Now, the old misanthrope that sits there and claws in, protects everything, says everybody's bad out there and I hate everybody and so on, he isn't any trouble to anybody. He's just sitting there being dead. You fall over doormats, don't you? You fall over doorknobs and other items and bric-a-brac. Well, you fall over him too. Now, the question arises, very simply, the question arises, what does a Thetan do best? Does he get ideas? Does he make things? Does he do this? Do that? No. He does all these things, but what does he do that most distinguishes him? Because, you see, man has been proving, we have to have this, because man has been proving lately that the body is a machine and that there's nobody there by proving that he can build electronic computers that can think better than brains. Anybody can do that. In fact, I caught my brain having a thought once. I almost dropped dead. I mean, I was very surprised. He can build this computer. He can build this robot. He can build various items which behave like bodies. They talk. They'll walk. They'll run. You know, and he could even mock things up so they have bloodstreams. He can do all sorts of things. Also, oddly enough, he can take biological devices and build them. He can actually build things out of cells and so on. It's quite remarkable, things they've done this way. But this is no reason for them to get disrespectful of bodies and people, because it didn't prove a thing except that another Thetan could do something with bodies and people. See? That's all proved. It didn't prove that every being in his totality was a machine. And that, it happens to be, the one big lie that is abroad in the world today. And it is a tremendous, cracking lie. That every being you run into is a machine. And he has buttons, and if you press them, he'll do this and that, and utter this and that, and so forth. Now, if you go on that theory, you'll keep looking in preclears for buttons to press to make them go da-da-da-da-da, you know. You know, make the heads turn? Now, what do you have to reach in order to get the whole of the being running? You have to reach the Thetan. You, as a living being, either take over the total control of a second body and make it go through all of its evolutions and eat its breakfast and dinner and get on trams and all sorts of things, or you have to say, he's alive too, and I have some confidence in his ability to run it. And unless we say, he can run his body and I'll run this body, we don't have any game at all. We find ourselves trying to control everything that moves throughout the entire universe. And let me assure you, that is difficult. Now, wherever we get throughout the entirety of physiology, we're at once stonied by something quite fascinating. Biology contains an ingredient that goes flickety-flack and procreates and manufactures itself and makes chemicals and synthesizes things, and boy, is that complicated. And we say at once, well, the thing that's doing this is the cell. Oh, now, really? How silly can you get? I know a Thetan isn't very big. He's just as big as he says he is, you see. But it is the weird thing about this whole thing. Why do we blame it on a cell? Well, that's because we can see it. Now, to accept that things exist which you yourself cannot see requires more trust than any scientists of my knowledge have. If they have to have the proof of mass for everything they believe, they're in trouble at once, because they'll never find out what is running a biological engine, and they will never find out how any engine of any kind ever got built anywhere. Now, let me show you how this is. This fellow says, all right, you see this beautiful machine here, this beautiful engine with electronic computer, and it does things, it spits, it does everything, and here's this gorgeous machine, and so forth, and that shows you human beings aren't so hot. I mean, he immediately concludes this. How silly. You ask him, who built the machine? Well, some men. Scientists. They're not human, you know. They built this machine. Well, who built them, you say? Oh, he says, you're going off into this old religious wing-ding. You're going off this thing about God made man and who made God and that endless proposition. Nobody ever proved it anyway. Dickens with it. Oh, he's in a silly state if he's in that one. No, we found the end of track on that one. A Thetan ran a body which built a machine. And we go a little bit further back in the track, and we find a Thetan started a genetic line that kept going on a life endowment, which some other Thetan could come along and, using the life endowment already there, could further endow it with life or deny it life. Simple. So in the final analysis, any machine that any scientist shows you, no matter how big, how shiny, how smart, how chromium-plated, or with what kind of a diamond-sparkled nameplate on it, was built by a Thetan. That's where the machine came from. And the degree that it runs is determined by the degree of life that people were willing to grant to it. And here again, in the most crudest scientific example, we have nothing in the long run but a Thetan building something. We have a nothingness, a Thetan, who is only something by his own postulate, but who is alive capable of giving life or not giving life, as the case may be. And the interplays of life are the interplays of refusal to grant life and the granting of life. And this interplay of life gives us the drama of life. And that's all the drama there is to it. Simple. How sick is a man? A man is as sick as he grants beingness, grants life, or doesn't grant life to a body or its mechanisms. Now, he can carefully select out from a body certain sick mechanisms. It's been sick. Now, let's take this on an engram level. Body was sick, had a mental image picture of the sickness while it was sick. He comes along, he grants life to the mental image picture then slaps back on the body, and the body gets sick. It's just a via of handling a body, the mental image picture. You've got old mental image pictures kicking around, you make one alive, fine. You get what you make alive, that's all. What is the whole problem of stimulus response? That thing which you make alive lives. And if you say man is a stimulus response machine, and that is all man is, then all you're going to make live in man is a stimulus response machine, and he's going to go walking around like a rabbit, and a rabbit doesn't have any ethics, morals, nobility, decency, or ability to think. And so we have our modern world. We have a world which conscienselessly can go on polluting an atmosphere with atomic radiation tests, which can contemplate the end of mankind just as though they weren't even interested. What kind of a denial of life is this? If we were to look at the men who are doing this, we would find sick men. They are sick men. They say it's all a machine. They'll grant life to a test tube, but not to their own right hand. They'll have dermatitis or something on their right hand. The only thing they can make live on a physical line, perhaps, is sickness. And so that's all they're going to use their weapons for. What is the curse of modern science? It has no curse except the intention of its use. If modern science were in the hands of rational men, all that is good in modern science would come into bearing and being and manifest itself in the world today. If it's in the hands of a bunch of insane fools who cannot grant beingness, even to their own right ears, then all that is sick and bad and inoperative in science will go into action in the world today. Now, we say there are some things that are bad and some things that are good. On what do we adjudicate this? Actually, these things are basically just considerations. They are no more than considerations. But remember, we are hung together by a certain set of agreements. Thee have agreed with me and me with thee about certain things. And we have agreements that some of these things are good and some of them are bad. And we don't think we ought to be dragging our bodies around through the streets at 18 yards a day. We think we ought to be able to walk down streets. So it's good to walk down streets and it's bad to drag yourself down streets. So we say one is good and one is bad. All right, we want to walk down streets. Well, that's all right. If we wanted everybody in the world to be operative on nothing but a stimulus response mechanism, if we wanted to have everybody in the world simply be a push-button machine, what would be the final result? It would be a dead world, just what is occurring at this moment, a world marked for slaughter. Push-button. There's nobody alive. He isn't there is the motto of this world today. If he isn't there, therefore, we are not going to grant any life in that direction particularly because it isn't alive. It's just a mass that walks. We're not going to count on any nobility of impulse or any decency or anything else from this other fellow. How could they possibly exist? We know what he is. He's a machine. That's all he is, just a machine. And we know what machines are. They consciously run over you. Go out and get in front of an automobile, put no driver behind the wheel, and let its clutch slip in. It'll run right over you. Doesn't have any conscience at all. Won't even stop and apologize. Well, that's the behavior of a machine. But now a driver behind that machine, oddly enough, not because of his social responses. Get off of that, please. Not because he has been trained to be good. To the degree that he hasn't been trained, that he is a machine, he will avoid running over you. Why? If he is capable or desires to grant life, he will grant life. Therefore, he doesn't immediately experience a craving to withdraw any life you have from you. So he won't run over you. It doesn't come down to training. It doesn't come down to social responses. It doesn't come down to all these neat little social science packages that everybody thought it did. It comes down simply to one thing. Is a person willing to... The word capable is used there in error. Is a person willing to grant life to his environment and his fellows? That's what it comes down to. Is he willing to? The only thing that can be injured is his willingness. He actually can be perverted in his understanding of his environment to the degree that he does not believe it is worth granting life to, or that it's dangerous to grant life to the environment in which he finds himself. And if he can be brought to this state of mind, he will stop granting life to it and will grant less and less and less life and come closer and closer and closer to home till he isn't even granting any life or beingness to himself. He's unhappy. He's miserable. He's also most likely to be a criminal and to engage in criminal actions. A criminal is a person who cannot see that the other man is alive. That's all a criminal is. Therefore, there is no liability in taking anything away from him or killing him. He has no responsibility because he knows the other fellow isn't alive and isn't there. He knows that body's just a machine, so therefore everybody's being silly to insist the body be treated with anything but harshness. This is his motto. This is what he goes on. No, I'm afraid that social response is not found on a training ground. Social response is as good as decent as, people are willing to grant life to things. You can look at any given society and find out how alive and how willing to grant life that society is by just looking at it and finding out whether or not it's running. It's just so simple. We don't have to look at its crime rates, insane rate, or any of these things. We go out and get in one of the cars and step on the starters, and the car runs. Okay, that's not a bad society. The Chinese society, which is willingly cutting everybody to pieces right at this moment and having just, oh, it's having a wonderful time. China usually does along this line. You get in the car in China and step on the starter. You better be ready to sit there quite a while if you're going to expect anything to happen. Because when anything does happen, also usually the hood flies off and baling wire jumps out of the middle of it. That society has been going downhill for some time with a vengeance, and it took a terrible dive in just very recent times. And ever since it took that heavy dive, nothing's been running in the society. It's quite fantastic. The philosophy of all men are machinery, all men are masses, has eaten deeply into the Chinese philosophy. Nothing's running. Quite interesting. American society, you find things running. The English society, you find things running. France, though, was overrun recently. It was very badly chewed up. It was made, oh, I don't know, against the local Gestapo agents, something or other. He was the Superman and everybody else were dogs, and it was against his particular orders that anybody breathe out of his left nostril. They had a good time, in other words, crushing the French. And you don't get too much response out of starters over in France right now. It's getting better, you see, coming up. But everywhere and behind every bush, you might say, the Frenchman is seeing a German still. He's still upset. He still points out to you the building where they killed so many tens of thousands of Frenchmen there in Paris the Gestapo headquarters, and he still points out this and that, and he isn't too willing to talk to you. All right, here we have this manifestation of granting of life, the willingness to grant life. If individuals are willing to grant life, then their environment lives. If they're unwilling to grant life, then the environment becomes confused, upset, and caved in. If a person only grants life to chaos and leaves all good principles gone, bad, abandoned, and so on, he'll have then nothing but chaos. It's unimaginable to live in a world that contains nothing but chaos. Now, how then would you impede this being called a Thetan? How would you slow him down? It's very simple. It's the simplest mechanism you ever heard of. One of its technical titles is this manufacture of the synthetic valence. We dream up synthetic characters, people who never lived, people who were criminals, people who were bums. We say that all this class of people are no good, and another, all that class of people are no good. Something the way I do with psychiatrists, you know. We dream up one of these examples, and we say, the intentions of criminals are so and so and so and so, and if you let them do so and so, they would do something else, and so on and so on. And half the people in the society are now criminals. You know, you could go on like this, and you finally get this Thetan unwilling to let those fellows live. And if we got him up to where he was unwilling to let 80% of the people in his environment live, we would have a criminal, wouldn't we? Now let's look this over again. It's too simple. It evades the eye. It's a very simple mechanism. All we do is invent people you shouldn't grant life to. And then we say the society is populated, and then we prove our example. And if we kept this up for a while, we would have a person believing that about 80% of the society was criminal, and then we would have made a person who would not grant life to 80% of the society, which is a criminal. Do you see how smoothly the mechanism works? That's the only thing. Now you have to explain to Johnny, little Johnny, that he mustn't touch stoves, and he mustn't do this, and he mustn't do that. Now you think automatically that Johnny will get himself eaten up in this physical environment if he isn't supervised pretty thoroughly. As a matter of fact, you would be amazed how well unsupervised Johnnies get along, and how poorly supervised Johnnies fall. They do a very bad job of it. They break their necks half the time. They have been told not to climb fences until a point where when they climb a fence, they fall off of it. It's highly doubtful if Johnny would fall off a fence unless he'd been educated to do so. So let's look this over, and let's see then what really ails our modern world. What really ails it. It's a simple thing. Now, somebody convinced the Germans that every other German, not the fellow himself, he knew he wasn't a Superman, but he thought the fellow in the next rank to him over that way, and the one on the left, the one on the right, he knew they were Supermen, and he knew that Himmler and Hess and Goebbels and Herring and Garbage and the rest of the characters. He knew all these fellows were Supermen. He'd been told so. See? But he knew he wasn't. And we had each German soldier more or less knowing he wasn't, but knowing the other fellows were. And that this body of Supermen, willy-nilly, was going to take over all of this body of people who were no good, bums, downtrodden, decadent, and so on. You undoubtedly have long since closed your ears to the tremendous flood vituperation which was coming from Berlin 20 years ago, something like that. Well, it was really a flood. My Lord, if there was anything left that was right with the English, or if there was anything left that was right with the Americans or the French or anything else, I'm afraid I didn't find it in Nazi literature. They were all bad. And they got everybody else in the world so all bad that this fellow who knew he wasn't a Superman, but knew the fellow on the left and right of him was, they knew they were, you see, he was then willing to go out and attack the rest of the world, and he engaged in a criminal action. See, that was a criminal action. Now, was he himself a criminal? Here we have this terrible philosophic question that has just been bothering people in these lines just for all these centuries. Was the fellow who did the attacking a criminal? No, he was a knight errant because he was doing a noble thing. He was withdrawing life from all those bad things. Therefore, the good things in the world could live. You might say that the wicked deeds of the world come about through educating people into knight errantry. All you've got to do is teach them about enough ogres. I imagine some of the old Cornish knights and so forth used to have an awful hard time. I bet they had an awful shock every now and then. They'd go out to kill this black giant, you know, that they heard about. And this fellow, big, brutal, hairy giant that was eating little children. The fellow would go glump, 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 glump in his tin suit, and he'd take a small spear or something of the sort, and he'd see this big, black, hairy beast, he thought. Fellow in a bearskin coat, and he'd run him through, kill him dead. I imagine it was with an awful shock that he usually find out the fellow was taking home a sack of potatoes to feed his wife and kids, to whom he was very good usually. What then is a Thetan invited to slay? He is always invited to slay a myth. Thus he is made to fight shadows. And fighting only shadows, he, of course, never attains any objective in the world. A Thetan is a being who is capable of giving life or of not giving life, and he is capable of it only to this degree, that he is willing to do so. If the world around him is bad, then he is unwilling to grant life. If the world around him he conceives to be good, he is willing to grant life to it. A world with life granted to it runs well. A world with no life granted to it goes into chaos and disappears. Now, this is the riddle of the centuries. It's an unfortunate thing that it turns out to be a simple fact. There's nothing very complicated about it. You take a gang of kids and you explain to them that all other gangs of kids all over the neighborhood are all bad. You've now created a criminal gang of kids. If they had to go and live with some of these other kids for a while, they'd find out they were just kids too. A Thetan never has anything to learn about himself. The only thing he can learn about at all is what he is granting life to. And it, of course, is not alive, and so has to have life granted to it in order for it to exist at all. So that's what he's trying to learn about. And when a fellow's trying to learn about himself, he's pulling a complete misnomer. He's saying, I'm trying to learn about some of the things I'm granting life to. That's not himself. The only thing there is to learn about himself is that he can be dissuaded from granting life to things that he probably should be granting life to, and that he can be encouraged to grant some life to things he probably ought to leave alone. In other words, he loses his discernment of what he ought to grant life and beingness to. Now, that is the final essence. You'll find around any person who is leading a confused or upset life, around any person, somebody who is granting life only to his confusedness and upsetness. See, but they won't grant any beingness to him any other way. So in order to stay in communication at all, he has to be confused and upset. Now, what is the closest thing we approximate to this granting of life? This is almost mystic, you see. It's almost mystic, except that there are more than 200 people right in front of me this moment who are doing it. See, you're granting life to your own bodies, to this room, to the world in which you live, to me up here, and so on. That's what you're doing, you see. And there's nothing very mystic about it. It's just what you're doing just at this instant. See? It's just about as incomprehensible as that. But where you are... where you are stopping that flow of life, where you're stopping it, and the areas to which you will not grant it, are areas that you've been carefully taught were bad, but are being monitored by Satan. They are bad to the degree that they are certain that you're bad and that the other fellow's bad. We have to know an awful lot about the other fellow before we can even engage in a game. The closest thing we have to life is communication. A-R-C is life, but we say we can closely represent a granting beingness by communication. You have somebody with a dead feeling foot, and you have him communicate with his foot for a while, his foot comes alive. Now you've really invited him by communication, on communication channels, to grant life to the foot. That is really what you have done and how you have gone about it, and that's all. So the portions of you turn out to be one, you. And I'm afraid that anybody that tries to make it much more complicated than that is simply inventing things to know about. Thank you.